Succession number 26561, Reel 7.
Wing Commander Bernard, Reel 7. We're talking about your mission on the 17th of February 1941 over Namur and the fact the airplane was going down. And you explained it was impossible to parachute, but we were cut off there. It was just too low, was it?
Yes, oh yes. We couldn't go out. We didn't have static lines on our parachute. And indeed, my parachute was a special one given to me by Geoffrey Quilter of the GQ Parachute Company. He was a World War I parachutist and developed a rival firm to the Irvine people. And he gave me this special parachute, which was unusual in so much as the whole parachute was formed down the back of your back and had a jack-in-a-box pilot chute that popped out when you pulled the D-ring. It had two. It had a green jacket which covered everything, and it was a very good revolutionary design.
Now, had you actually jumped with this one?
No, I hadn't jumped with that actual one. I jumped with another of his. The canopy was the same, but this was a new one, in so much as the whole of the parachute was looked a bit like a wasp with this on your back.
And was this wasn't specially designed for spies? This was just an experimental model that had been given
to you?
Yes,
specially for spies and,
and
generally, yes, it wasn't special for me, but it was given to me as a private gift by Geoffrey Quilter, and he'd given me a little enamel parachute badge, which was the equivalent of the Irvine's Caterpillar.
Now, what happened? You're going down. I mean, how did you feel? I mean, you wouldn't have much time to get down.
No, I was busy throwing things out, anything I could lay in the dinghy. Everything went out, and we were told to assume the crash positions.
Now,
which was the crash positions
that?
Was... there was a main spar, wing spar, went through the fuselage, and it was like a big step before you went through the wing root area. And we, Di Davis and I and Jimmy Campbell, the three of us, crouched down with our backs to this giant beam that went across the wings and through the fuselage. We crashed in, and there was an almighty crumpling noises and so on, and the wings tore off because it was a small wood. And we
actually landed in the wood?
Into the wood, yes. And
what was the impact like for you?
Pretty bad, pretty horrendous, yes. I only had cuts and scratches, but it was very bad in so much as Skipper Keast, Frank his name was, yeah, Frank Keast, was in the front with Baker, an Australian who had joined us, and he was the second pilot. And they were both, as it went in, there was mud came up, and he was blinded. They were both blinded with the mud from this.
Permanently?
No, they recovered subsequently, and I think they had cuts and bruises which wouldn't permit them to. Baker wasn't too bad, but he was the only one, because he was an Australian, he was the only one who had a pistol, by the way. The rest of us were not armed. We couldn't afford the handguns for us at that stage of the war.
So how badly were you thrown about? Did your bracing work?
Oh, we the position we were in was a good protection area, yes. But the whole aircraft, and then we saw this, and it didn't catch on fire. It had a remarkably good Gravner system, which... foot fires out the moment you crashed. And so we wanted to get rid of our aircraft. We went back, I went back and blew up the identification for Enfro. There was a cartridge in that, which blew it all up, so that the Germans couldn't use the circuitry or anything.
So it was a cartridge in it to blow it up. I mean,
it was built in, and you just pulled a switch and it blew the whole casing up.
Anything else you destroyed?
No, they say they were partially blinded. We fired Baker's revolver into the petrol tanks, but they were self-sealing, and nothing happened with this. So in the end, we got the fire axe out of the fuselage and hacked open the wing petrol, which contained the petrol tanks, and stood back from it and dragged Skipper Keast out from the front cockpit, and then we set fire to it by firing a very light or signalling pistol into this gashed wing, which access to the fuel tanks, and they blew off. They decided that the others weren't very well. I was the only one that was sort of walking wounded, and the others were all shattered knees and all sorts of things. And I had a hunting compass and I spoke French, and they decided that I should push off alone, which I did. But it was snowing at the time, and an eerie silence in this wood with the snow falling off the trees and coming down, and my thoughts were, gosh, what's my mother going to say about this?
Now, what were you wearing? We haven't actually. What would you be wearing?
I'd be wearing on that occasion inner and outer sidcuts. No, sorry. I'd got an Irvin jacket then. Yes, the woolly, you know, the big zipper with a sheepskin thing on top of a sidcut. And my helmet went, I had a side cap. And because we were always landing somewhere other than our own airfield, I used to carry a very small, in my knee pockets, I carried a small washing outfit, a little leather case with toothbrush, razor and soap and a little tiny towel, so that at least I could be clean when I came. And I'll tell you about what the Germans said about that.
Did you have any other equipment or gear? You know, some they used to have escape maps and things. I don't know.
No, they hadn't done those.
They hadn't invented them yet.
They hadn't invented those at that time.
So just your uniform.
I always carried a hunting compass, you know, quite a substantial one, and I had this, but I had no maps, but I knew I was going to head due west. Get back through Spain.
But the others had accepted they were going to be taken prisoner.
Yeah, they weren't capable. They were too badly crashed up. But I say the skipper was blind at that time. He recovered his sight. They cleaned his eyes out and so on. And I don't know what was wrong with Baker, but you know, we weren't too badly off considering the crash, where the wings, half the wings either side, had been chopped off with the woods as we went in.
What happened next then?
I was kind of, remember this was about 6 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning time. And I was just trying to put as much distance between myself and the wrecked aircraft, and I stumbled across as I was going across in the first light, the it wasn't even dawn properly. I stumbled across crossing a road, and two German guards spotted me. And if I'd said bon matin and gave them a morning greeting and walked on, but I froze in my tracks and that attracted them. I was very stupid to do that, but I wasn't very practiced in avoiding things. At the age of 20, by the way.
How did they treat you as they took you prisoner?
Those guards were all right. I was amused at the short rifles, and they all were carrying little breastplates on there, which was a guard duty device. But then the Gestapo stepped in. I was captured by them, and they took
me. Where did they take
you? I was unarmed. Took me to the centre of Namur, which turned out to be the Gestapo headquarters. And they took me to a sort of substation for the guards, generally. And they put me in a car and showed off racing speeds in the car to the town. And then they'd investigated the crashed aircraft, and they found my parachute with my name in it, by the way. I thought it had burnt in the, but like a bundle of newspapers, you can frequently set fire to them and read the middle bundle.
And
then they called in the Gestapo at this stage, and this Gestapo were interrogating me, and then they remove this to.
Now tell me in as much detail as you can about this.
The interrogation.
How did they start?
Well, they were able to speak. They tried French, and my French wasn't. I pretended it wasn't good enough, and they got another Gestapo man who cope with English, and he was asking me, my squadron, what was I doing. And why have I got a funny parachute? Was I a paratrooper? And to which I replied, name, rank, number. And then they said, right, so he got called in a couple of guards, and they were getting nothing out of me other than name, rank, number. And the two guards sat me in this chair and pulled this tooth out without so that I could talk better. But I didn't. I'm very proud of that gap.
It was just simple torture.
Yeah.
It must have hurt.
Oh, God, yeah. But, I was absolutely 100% dedicated to my country.
And it was one of the front teeth. Front bottom.
Mm.
Still, you've left it.
Yeah, I'm proud of it, yeah.
Did they hit you?
No, there was just this thing with I don't know whether pliers or dentist pliers. I can't remember that. Oh, I didn't see them, actually. But two of them held me down.
I presume they were restraining you.
Oh, yeah, I had two guard either side restraining me, and the other one, But then they...
But you still wouldn't tell them anything?
Still wouldn't tell them anything, right? Name, rank, and number is what I've been trained to give away, and I was committed to the Secrets Act, and I was going to hold it to that.
So what did they do? How long? So that was the only thing they did.
It must have gone on for hours, yes.
But just happened. They did no more violence to you.
Not after that. Now they saw. They commented on my youthful appearance, and they gave me some horrible bread, and to keep me alive. Because I hadn't eaten for 24 hours.
And you presume you were in solitary confinement when you weren't being interrogated?
Yes, that's right. In this funny place I've even avoided, because of the Secrets Act, I even, when I was stationed in NATO, I wouldn't go back near there at all, because at the time I was still under the 30-year secrecy. I was very intrigued to go back there, but I thought, no, I'm not to give anything away. Foolish now when I think about it. But I remember going through this, had an old coaching, I think it must have been an old inn, I think, and it had a door in the middle of this coaching door.
And it was just a normal room of the cell, not a special prison cell?
No, it was a normal room.
Barred window or no window?
I don't remember a window anywhere. Just a chair and a table, and these about four German guards.
No, I mean your cell, when you were back in your solitary confinement cell.
That was later on, yes. I wasn't in the... Yeah, no.
I asked you if you were in a cell, and you said yes. Hang on. So you were just being interviewed. They didn't put you anywhere in between sessions of interrogation?
No.
Right, okay.
Sorry, yes.
I understand that.
Later on I was put in a cell, yes.
So you were basically in for hours being interviewed?
Yeah.
About
12 hours, and I still hadn't had sleep, of course, and they kept me awake. Changed the guards and so on.
And what happened next?
And then they decided they gave up on me, and they had specialists later on, I discovered, but they were determined to show me off from all sorts of places. And they put me on a train at Namur. But it was rather interesting, the crowd gathered round, all the Belgian people were having a look at this, and the Germans were sort of showing off that prisoner. And the one very pretty girl gave me a victory sign. I didn't know about the victory signs at that time. I only knew the rude two-finger salute. And I thought to myself, well, it's all right for you, but blow you jack, you know, sort of salute. And anyway, they gave me a little chair, and I set off, and I sat in the train, and by this time I'd got a German captain, a Hauptmann, and he had put into a special carriage, and there were two guards either side of him and two guards side of me, and there was five Germans guarding little Dave. I stared him out, and he stared me out on this journey. We were going through to Luxembourg, and he suddenly spotted my flying boots. I had black leather flying boots, and I always kept a Scottish dirk in there with its thistle head on it. And he suddenly spotted this, and he rapped out some orders, and all four of them leapt on me and removed this offending dangerous weapon which I'd used for sharpening pencils and getting rounds out of machine guns that had jammed and cut rigging lines in my parachute. They hadn't got a proper parachute knife in those days, but that was my own private one.
So
and they wanted to know. The other thing that surprised the interrogator was this little toilet outfit, this little leather case with a, I think it was no bigger than a large card case, but it contained all the requirements for keeping oneself shaven and toothbrush and so on.
Did they confiscate it, or did they keep?
No, they confiscated that, yes, and my cigarette lighter and several things were taken from me.
Now, where were you going to Luxembourg or through Luxembourg?
We got out at Luxembourg, and we were parading us all over the place. By this time, the others had joined us at Luxembourg, and we put into
the others from your plane.
Yeah, that coordinated us at Luxembourg, and we were marched. Oh, on this train, they took my flying boots when they took this one, and I went to the toilet and I was trying to get out, and they burst the door down and found me trying to get through this window in the toilet, and took my boots off me then. And it was still snowing, remember, it's still February and snow, and I was marched through the streets of Luxembourg in my stocking feet, and they'd kept my boots, so I had them returned ultimately in Luxembourg actually. And we slept on, I think it was a court room, it wasn't a proper cell, it was a court room, and we slept on the public benches with the guards either side of us in Luxembourg. And then we went on to the...
And what state were your friends in?
They weren't hospitalised, I think they'd done their eyes and they were bandaged up in places, and not badly wounded at all. Remarkable, really, for such a crash. As I say, it was blinded with the mud in your eyes, you know.
Now, so what happened there?
We marched through the street on the cobblestones, and I went back there a lot many years later, and I took my boots off, and when we were on holiday, but that's not for this. Yes, and we moved out then, and we went on to Frankfurt with more guards, and we were held at Frankfurt on Oder, not Frankfurt, Maine. And there was Dulag Luft, which was Oberursel, and that was a proper interrogation centre. Well, they didn't torture me there, but they kept me going. They heated the room up and deprived me of...
Let's set the scene first. So what was the setup when you arrived at Dulag Luft? What could you see? What was the layout of the camp?
It was like a typical German farmhouse, really, a giant farmhouse. But it had been specially redesigned, I think, with bars on the windows, and part of them were full up, and there were wood lining, and just a small bench, I don't think there wasn't even a cot in it, just a chair and a sort of table. And they kept calling me in and carrying on with this interrogation.
Now, what methods were they used for interrogation there?
Oh, just a Red Cross form. It went on for 2 days. But they weren't getting anything out of me at all.
So what methods and techniques could you observe them using?
Talk. Yes, they just kept pulling me out. They put the lights on and turned the temperature of the cell up and didn't give me any water. And that was a very uncomfortable period.
But no violence, no more teeth?
No more teeth, no. By this time, it was Luftwaffe. They were more gentlemanly than the soldiers and the Gestapo. But they tried all sorts of ways. Sonderführer Eberhardt, I think, was the name of the main Sonderführer, little leader, under leader.
And Eberhardt?
Eberhardt, yes.
What was he like?
Oh, he tried to be very friendly. And got anyway, he didn't go into bullying tactics. He just tried subtle interrogation, you know. And telling me that the rest of the crew had told him, so there was no point in me keeping quiet any longer. And I still came to the name, rank and number.
He couldn't trick you into talking about anything else?
No, not a thing.
Do you think the crew had told him anything, or do you think it was just...
No, I don't think they did, no. We're all very trained, very conscious of this.
Did they have any idea of what you were doing? I mean, did they...
They were suspicious. This parachute really worried them. They asked me what it was for, and I said, oh, it's my parachute.
But they never knew what flight you were in, you know,
didn't know, because, of course, the Germans didn't have any opposite outfit until 1944. They started copying our ideas that we'd started joining the Battle of Britain.
So they were suspicious?
Suspicious of my spy activities, yes, because of my unusual parachute. But they couldn't prove anything.
Now, where were they keeping you when they weren't actually interrogating you?
In this cell.
And that was solitary confinement cell?
Yes, yes.
And what was it like in there for you?
Oh, terribly hot, and I think it was 24 hours before they gave me a piece of bread and a cup of water there.
And how were you feeling?
Very tired, because I wasn't allowed sleep. And this is part of the weakening process.
How did they stop me from sleeping?
By waking me up all the time.
Just physically, not loud noise or anything like that?
Oh, no. The light was on all the time, and they'd come in and make sure I wasn't asleep.
And what state of fatigue had you reached? Because fatigue can have different effects on people. What effect do you think it had on you?
Well, I tried to keep sane. I was counting the number of lines and the grains of wood and silly things like that to keep myself mentally alert and stop myself worrying. I was worried, obviously, but, you know, not stressfully so.
Now, so anything else they were doing to you during that period?
No, just I must have had 20 or so bouts of interrogation, but they never got a damn thing out of me. They gave me forms to fill in, which I just put name now in a number and said I don't know anything else.
Were you able to establish communication with any of the other prisoners in the neighbouring cells?
No, not at that time, no. There was a compound adjoining that which you were put into later.